My next guest is a playwright and actor who is bringing a new duo of works to the Smock Alley Theatre next week, the first part of which is a stage memoir of sorts where he explores his own personal history as a baby born in a Magdalen laundry. His voice may be familiar to many of you when you hear it, particularly fans of the late Gerry Ryan, with whom he soldiered on many shows over the course of almost 20 years. John Farrell, a very good morning to you.
Same to you, Miles. Good to see you today.
Now, you don't know an awful lot about your early days. You don't know an awful lot about your mother. What have you been able to find out about the circumstances of your birth and how you ended up in America?
Sure. I mean, the piece itself started because I found I had a good range of very early young memories. And I think partly those were formed because of the experience of being in foster homes and orphanages, as I describe it. You're always making maps. You're always trying to figure out where you are. So you tend to remember these things better. And I wanted to kind of tell this story, but from the child's point of view, you know, from the 3-year-old or the 12-year-old, how you would see the world, how you would negotiate and be with it. What happened for me that was really critical was when my mother passed away 2 years ago, my adoptive mother, Rosemary, who figures prominently in the play, because the family was pretty dysfunctional and numerous.
She liked ironing.
She loved ironing. Ironing was paradise for her, you know? That might even be mentioned in the excerpt today. I'm not sure. But in any case, she passed away, and I suddenly discovered this whole trove of letters hidden in a safety security box at the bank so that, you know, obviously that no one would ever even know they were there. And they were a series of letters that my mother had correspondence with the Sisters of Mercy here, Mid Abbey Street. And it basically made the reference of who she should speak to, because the sisters also had what I describe as a discounted baby outlet in in Bay Ridge in Brooklyn called the Angel Guardian Home. And I have memories of the orphanage. I have memories of foster homes, probably going back to about two and a half.
This is in Ireland
now. No. I came over from Ireland very early, I believe. Right. I had no memories of that.
Right.
So this was quite a surprise, because it was also in the context, because you know I came and I lived in Ireland for many years, of the fact that I always had this yearning to come to Ireland. And I remember my adoptive mother was very anxious about that fact. And I discovered, of course, because she knew. For me, the big thing was that I was finally able to forgive my mother, you know, because I grew up always feeling there was this stigma, this shame, that we were sinners, that we were bad.
You knew you were adopted.
Oh, I absolutely knew I was adopted. And I was fairly crafty and cunning about it because, as I say, at one point, even kids, you know, they make the best of a situation. So they know how to, you know. So I was pretty cunning, even at 3. but I always knew, you know. And the question of coming to terms with that over your lifetime is that you often find that you have, you know, very serious periods of feeling isolated, abandoned. You feel, you know, that your mother rejected you. And when I began to see the Magdalen connection beginning to appear, I suddenly realized that my mother was a victim too. And that was a big breakthrough for me. And I hope the audience as well sees the way that these kind of trauma, much of it is rather comic, as you may have gathered, you know.
You began, though, you did quite a bit of research, didn't you? You started to do some research late on in life.
And that may be kind of ambivalent. I was rather ambivalent about it, because part of me was like, well, I had long ago come to the conclusion that my life was in my future, that it wasn't the past, and that I had to let go of all of that and the sorrow, the disappointment. But I've been ambivalent. Mm-hmm. I have been being encouraged now to pursue further, because many people are saying that my natural mother, if she was still alive, would probably be very happy to hear that I'm well. And that plays on my mind that might be a very strong objective. But I am nearly 60 now, Miles. Year 60, so.
So you got to kind of deal with it and move
on. You know.
The play, the first part of the play, Three Lies About Brooklyn, it's clear from that you have mixed feelings, to put it mildly, towards the Catholic Church. Why is that?
Well, I think I describe it as a kind of Stockholm syndrome, that when you grow up at the mercy of the church, they are your only way out of it, because they forgive you. They tell you you've sinned. They tell you how to atone for your sins. They tell you what to expect in life. And so you very often, I think a lot of children in my position develop a very complicated love-hate relationship with the church. Now, because of my own history, because there was some serious sexual abuse when I was quite young, this began to seem to lead to a pattern where I found myself was with certain clerics who would pass boys around and things. I don't know, does that sufficiently kind of address the question?
I'll tell you what might address the question is an extract from the play, because I think this sort of gets across why you have this ambiguous attitude towards the church. So perhaps you'd just do that one for us, if you would.
All right then, Miles, I'll give it a go. And again, remember, the voice is the voice of the 12-year-old.
The child.
The child. When I was 12, winding down eighth grade, I found myself making a pass at my best friend. Maybe it was thoughts of high school and separation. Maybe I was sort of in love with him, even though he wasn't my type. At 12 years old, I had a type. But since the nuns failed to instill modesty in me at an earlier age, I was rarely shy about things. Anyway, he told his mother, who told my mother, who cried. Rosemary cried a lot. Crying was like her hobby. Ironing was the other. Crying while ironing? Paradise. She used to iron my shoelaces. And maybe that was her way of loving me. So anyway, I had to go see the priest. Sending a 13-year-old boy to see a priest because he might have homosexual tendencies? What could go wrong? Father O'Toole, I kid you not, he placed his hand on my knee and insisted it was just a phase I was going through. Well, having realized from the hard determination in Rosemary's eyes as she dragged me to the rectory that I did not have many options left, I was quick to agree. The good father smiled, delighted at getting all that out of the way, and his hand inched up to my thigh. It was a relief that it was a phase and not a sin. It was even more reassuring to realize that Father O'Toole was going through the same phase himself. I loved the Catholic Church. She became my home. I dreamed of running away and becoming a Trappist. Oh, what boy doesn't? You see, I wasn't so much indoctrinated by the Catholic Church as invented by them. They were the disease they claimed to cure. I got to pray with some very fine-looking seminarians in my time, but ultimately, the Catholic Church was too gay, even for me. And at the same time, not gay enough.
Okay, you can see where the humour comes in. And I suppose you can see where the humour has to come in as well. You describe the home that you grew up in as dysfunctional. What was your relationship? You talk a little bit about your relationship with your adoptive mother. What was your relationship with your adoptive father, who is still alive? He's a very elderly man.
Yes, he is. He is. And I'm happy to say and report that in later years, we've actually become fairly good buddies. He's going to be 95 in September. But basically, my father and my uncle had had rheumatic fever as children, so they were, in fact, infertile. And this became a source of real difficulty between my parents. And it was Rosemary, my mother, who was very, very keen to get herself a certified Irish Catholic baby at any cost or from any place. My father, therefore, was very distant to me when I was younger. I was bad at sports. I didn't get the whole Ebbets Field thing when I was a kid. So I just basically, I let
him
down
time and
time again.
That's the Brooklyn Dodgers for the uninitiated.
Do you know? So the relationship there was difficult because I was very much, can I say it, Rosemary's baby.
All right. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
Very, very briefly, yes. There's another half to the evening, and this is Walt Whitman, Time Traveller. It's an Irish section to Walt Whitman, Time Traveller. Please explain.
Well, Walt Whitman, as you probably know, is the great national poet of America, and he is, in fact, also from Brooklyn, which some people don't realize. That's where he grew up. He's a Brooklyn boy. And basically, we've generated this idea of Whitman, what he would be like today. So we time travel him, and he goes around. It's kind of a quasi little steampunk thing, but he interacts with contemporary events as well as with the past. And it's the effect is very good. So it's a work that no matter where we're going to play, we adjust it to where we play or who the crowd is we're playing to, or if we're playing at the, you know, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, or if we're playing, you know, Francis's Tavern on the 4th of July, which I did this year.
So you do a bit of vamping.
Yeah, it's very much because you'll notice that the whole free verse that Whitman introduces into poetry then in the mid-19th century, you know, he's a beat kind of guy. He's with it, you know. And I think if he was alive today... Miles, I'm very, very happy to be here with you today, live from Camden, New Jersey. He'd love it. He'd be here. He'd be having his picture taken.
Just before I let you go, you were to most radio listeners, you would be indelibly associated with Jerry Ryan. You must have been shocked, absolutely shocked at his death.
Yeah, absolutely. do you know? But I always knew that Jerry worked hard, and maybe sometimes he drove himself too hard and partied too hard. But Jerry had that kind of energy you thought would go on forever. You know, he was like a celestial body. The heat from Jerry was always exciting, always energizing. So the fact that he passed was a real shock, and a very important and a valued friend taken away, you know? It was really sad. Because I did his show for like 20 years. I'm sure you know
that. Yeah, 20 years. Well, his energy, I think his energy is still, it's still around the place. Some of it will probably seep into you on the way out of the studio and will inhabit you when you are performing in Smock Alley in Temple Bar from the 28th to the 31st of August in those two new shows. John, thank you very much indeed for talking
to us. Thank you, Miles. You take care now. Good luck.
And you too. And details and tickets, www.smockalley.com. That's the new productions, the new performances by John Farrell. Take a break.